We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Hello and welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 39. I am Chris Webster, and I've got with me, as always, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. Today, I talked to Dr. Garfinkel about animal-human headdresses, and specifically a few that were found that use bighorn sheep horns and skull fragments and some beads, and how we can date those and what it means to the archaeological record. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. Dr. Alan, how you doing?
Oh, good. How are you, Professor Chris Webster? This is our 39th Rock Art Podcast together. Can you imagine that? One more hour and we can fill a whole week worth of hourly. They can just listen to us.
That's
for
right.
40 hours going, and they can clock in a full week's worth of work.
That's an interesting way to put it.
I think it's quite an accomplishment. I think when we get to 52, we ought to have an anniversary to celebrate the year.
One a week
for a full year, don't you think?
I mean, that's always an accomplishment in podcasting world. So
yes,
making it a year, I mean, making it to 10 episodes in podcasting world is usually something special, but making it all the way to a year, yeah, it's another milestone.
Yeah. So I'm still very excited. We have a guest that will be slated in the next week or two, and he's the former director of the Mataranga Museum. Has two degrees, one in archaeology, but the other in some other discipline.
We'll find out.
Physics, and
okay,
he will come on board and talk about the obsidian dating and its relationship to rock art. But he moved up to Washington.
Okay.
Everybody's on the move. So that's moving ahead. Now, tonight, it is indeed Tuesday, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'm told that I am featured as the guest scholar on the History Channel tonight. On their,
really?
On the Skinwalker Ranch show, which I think is the second most popular show. So millions of viewers are going to see me wandering around Utah and talking about rock art and archaeoastronomy and the imagery that is represented in some of the glyphs. And also in the, in sort of a, there's also a geoglyph that was there, sort of a earthen figure.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm not going to be able to see it, but I will see it shortly, I presume, as a recorded episode. But people have been calling me and telling me that you're going to be on television, Alan.
Well, it's already aired for those listening to this podcast, so definitely go check that out. Where did you say that? What network is that on again?
It's on the History Channel, and it's called the Skinwalker Ranch. It's the number 2 show ever to be aired on there. And they worked with me, and they sought me out because they tried to get one of my colleagues, and he declined when he saw the liability form. This is supposed to be a very dangerous and supernatural area, and very odd and crazy things occur there. I was a little reticent myself, and I called them and I said, you know, this liability form is a little bit, has taken me aback, and I'm considering to decline. And they said, no, don't believe any of that stuff. There's nothing wrong here, and just continue it. So I said, but it says that you're not liable for any sort of death or destruction.
Nice.
So it did give me pause, but I went anyways.
Well, all right then.
And nothing untoward happened. How's that?
I did go to the History Channel website, and Secret of Skinwalker Ranch is right on the main page. You just scroll down a little ways, and there it is. So if you've got, I think if you've got a, you need to have a cable subscription or something, but you can probably watch it right there online. But let's talk about that.
Well, I'm sure that after it airs, there will be a lot of buzz amongst the rock art fans and others who follow the Skinwalker Ranch. It's a very popular show.
Nice, nice.
And of course, I read nothing about it, so I didn't want to influence my objectivity when I went out there. So I knew nothing.
That's right.
Really knew little to nothing about it. But
okay,
it's a fantastic area. So that gets us into the Great Basin and into the Desert West, and sort of as a nice introduction to our topic of this evening, or today's rock art podcast. That's more about animal ceremonialism and how it's embedded as a religious metaphor for indigenous cultures throughout the far West, and even into the American Southwest, and even as far afield as Mesoamerica, of course. And what I'm going to use as my case study is a one-of-a-kind discovery that was made in the Barrier Canyon in the San Rafael Swell, where they discovered within a little niche, a rock niche, a bighorn sheep headdress.
Okay.
Actually in rather good shape, that included a cloak for one's head, and had six Olivella beads hanging from it with opossum milkweed cordage. And that's the only such object in any museum that I'm aware of anywhere in the world.
So what does that mean?
Well, it means a lot. And I think we'll talk about it bit by bit here. So the object, of course, was recovered in a place called Robber's Roost in the San Rafael Desert. It's near the Green River.
Okay.
And the region is one where it was a desert archaic, or Fremont people, as they're called. Fremont were part-time hunter-gatherers and part-time agriculturalists. And the rock art sites that featured there have these horned anthropomorphs, human beings, and depictions of bighorn sheep and bighorn hunters armed with both the bow and arrow and the spear or dart thrower. So it's sort of significant that we were able to actually identify and discover such a headdress. It appeared in the display case in the prehistoric museum there in a part of Utah. And the display, it was a display around it. It was a privately owned headdress. Mm-hmm. And it was discovered back in the 1960s. And I think one thing that was interesting was no one had ever analyzed it nor written it up. All they had talked about sort of as a secondary referrals was that it did indeed exist. And it's in Price, Utah. So what does it mean to have a bighorn headdress there on display in Price, Utah? Well, one of the basic questions we have is, where was it found? Why was it there? How old is it? And what could they have used it for? The reason it intrigued me and was so important or significant to my mind was because a colleague of mine, a very prominent archaeologist who's one of the world's experts on sort of rock art and shamanism and considered to be a central figure in the debates on that subject of rock art, shamanism, hunting magic, etc., asserted confidently in print several times that there could never be such a object, that the bighorn sheep horns were way too heavy, and that all the depictions of bighorn sheep horned hunters were simply metaphors for these medicine persons, and talking about their visions. And it was a conflation, a mixture, you know, a combination of the bighorn sheep and the hunter. And that just didn't seem to make sense to me. So when we actually discovered one of the key questions was, how did they possibly engineer to have these bighorn sheep horns that are rather heavy and actually put them into a headdress? Well, they hollowed them out and they only used the actual sheath, the outsides of the horns, and they got rid of the horn cores. And then they attached those to the skull cap of the bighorn. They cut it up and then they put a leather hood over it. Now, when you talk about ethnography, the anthropological studies here, there's a lot of discussion about bighorn sheep and animal horned headdresses. And the issue is, are those just metaphors? Are they in the rock drawings and paintings? Do they mean to be representing disguised or adorned human beings who are hunters? Or again, is it the self-depictions of these shamans, medicine persons, somehow memorializing their visions as animal humans in the supernatural? Or are they, or is it both? Are they doing a little bit of both?
Right.
So in general, what we find is that horned animals, or indexical animals, as they're called, are the centers of hunting cults and also religious rituals that relate to those animals. They could be deer in the northwest coast. They could be bison on the plains. They can be bighorn sheep. They can be other animals as well. But often there are rituals and adornments or costumes that are integrated into the religious activities of Native people. And this, we believe, goes on for thousands of years, because you find it both in rock art and in even as early as tens of thousands of years ago, when the cave bears were hunted. And there's cave bear shrines that are placed where they have the skull sitting on top of a stone pillar as though it was ritually being revered. So this is part and parcel of our ancestry and also part of our sort of religious accoutrements. So when we found this bighorn sheep headdress there, we, of course, wanted to know, was it a hunting disguise? Was it a religious item? How old was it? And how could we possibly date it?
Right.
Now, it had these six olivella beads. Olivella shell beads are called purple olivella, or they're the small beads that you find on the coast of California. They're white. They are biconical in shape and rather small. And the native people of California ground them down and use them as money beads and as shell beads for the last 10,000 years. Wow. They were traded extensively. They were manufactured mainly on the coast, and actually mainly in the Channel Islands, where they almost specialized in the production of these olivella shell beads. And then they were exchanged throughout California and even into the American Southwest. In the area of southern Arizona, they found hundreds and hundreds of them, beginning at about 500 BC with burials. So they were very, very valuable, very treasured items, etc. So when we found those shell beads, I said, well, we ought to get a hold of Chester King. He's got a nickname, Chester Chumash, and he's the shell bead guy for California. He's been around the block. He lives in the Topanga Canyon there in the Los Angeles mm-hmm. Basin. Never moved, been there his whole life. And if anybody knows something about Olivella beads, it would be Chester. So I called him up. He knows me from when I was a young man, which I was many, many decades ago. Mm-hmm. I volunteered on one of his excavations. And I said, Chester, we have some Olivella beads that are attached to a bighorn sheep headdress. And I'd like you to see if you can classify them and tell me how old they are. So I sent him some mm-hmm. photographs. He said, Alan, you know, those photographs are wonderful, but I can't really tell anything unless I have the beads in my hand. I need to look at the beads. I need to magnify them and study them so you can classify them and tell you something more specifically about them. I said, okay, well, let me talk to the museum curator. So I said, I know these are one of a kind and very rare, but I talked to Chester and he says he'd need one or two beads himself there to, in fact, be able to classify them, categorize them as to type, and then we can figure out how old they were.
Yeah, let's actually pick this up on the other side of the break because I want to talk more about these beads. It sounds like we're really getting into it. Let's go ahead and take a break and continue talking about these beads on the other side. Back in a minute.
Thanks.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 39. Before the break, you started talking about these beads, and I'm interested in these beads a lot because, you know, we can tell quite a few things about beads, and I'm waiting to hear before I mention it because I can't actually remember the technique here, but I'm waiting to hear if something comes up. So let's pick the story back up with these beads and what you guys did with them in order to get them analyzed.
So again, we went to the bead man, Chester King. They mm-hmm. nicknamed him Chester Chumash. And what he did was he said he needed the actual beads. So we mailed him two beads, count them. And it looked as though all the beads were the same. And he looked at these beads and he said, Alan, you know, these beads are very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. I says, why is that? And he says, well, these are beads that are ground on their sides. And in fact, they are punched. They're called side ground punched beads. They have a certain kind of a classification. And in fact, they were only used for a very brief amount of time. So they have a very specific chronology. And that chronology tells us that, in fact, they were about 1,000 years old, which is rather amazing because the preservation was so, you know, so high. I mean, the actual cordage that connected the beads was still tethered into the holes of the headdress, and the beads were hung on that headdress for 1,000 years.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, sitting in that little rock shelter. So I said, well, that's interesting. So we have 1,000-year-old beads, these Olivella shell beads that are ground and punched, that only lasted from about let's say, I think it was 1020 AD to 1160 AD, let's say, about 1,000 years ago. And I said, but you know what? We've just dated the beads, but we haven't dated the headdress, because Native people have an interesting habit of doing things called heirlooms. And so with heirlooms, what they do is they will pick up artifacts that are from a different age, much earlier, and then they will incorporate them into their regalia, their ceremonies, their rituals. And I was concerned that we might be misdating or misattributing those beads to the same age as the bighorn sheep headdress.
Okay.
So I said, well, let's try and cross-correlate that and see if those beads, in fact, do date the headdress. And the way I would recommend doing that is to talk to the AMS Radiocarbon Laboratory in Texas. That's the one that has the greatest confidence. It's really the go-to radiocarbon laboratory that's done, does the dates all over the world. And I'm sure that they could advise us as to what to date to have the greatest confidence in the dates. And I said, well, should we date the bone in the skull? They said, no. How about the horn core of the headdress itself? They said, no. Those both might give aberrant readings, and there's not enough collagen, not enough organic material in either element that would allow us to get a robust and valid date. I said, what about the hemp? What about the cordage, the milkweed itself that attaches the beads to the headdress? They said, yes, that would give you a great date. If you can send us some of that, we think we'd get a good date. So we sent it in, and lo and behold, it came back exactly the same age as the beads.
Nice.
That's good within correlation. Within the sigma, yeah. Within the plus or minus factor, I think it dates between AD 1020 and 1160. Calibrated age is 930 to 8, about 800 to 900 years old in that ballpark. And so we knew we had something that was rather remarkable and time sensitive. Now, we were concerned that this might be just a one-off. And someone might say, well, this is the only one that's ever been collected. It's the only one that's in a museum anywhere. So then we began to scan the literature, and lo and behold, there's all kinds of other headdresses that are like this, but they're incomplete. There's one called the Mobley headdress that was found in the same area. There's another one that they discovered as another specimen that was called the Allen headdress that was at the Capitol Reef National Park. And they did a sketch of that, and there's a little article about it. And they actually, both of those were manufactured exactly the same way. And my executive producer, Paul Goldsmith, who did the Talking Stone movie, has a close friend. He's an anonymous collector, and he has a headdress that's identical to the one that's in the museum.
Oh, wow.
It's cut the same way. It has holes the same way. It's got the cordage there and everything else. He did not want to identify himself, nor did he want anyone to know that he actually owns this. He purchased it from a couple of these cowboy archaeologists, as they're called, back from when they were doing some cave work back in the 1920s. And so he probably has one of the rarest bighorn sheep headdresses. Certainly the only one in the private collection I'm aware of. So there you go.
Wow.
Why is this so important, Alan?
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering not only why is this so important, but, you know, you've got two of these things, which means, okay, now it's kind of a thing, right? I mean, one is something, but two means there's something going on here that's a lot bigger, right? And they probably weren't. I mean, how close were they found to each other? Did they have a provenience for the both of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
They found the same general area. So it appears that the Fremont people about 1,000 years ago were doing the same thing that the bighorn sheep depictions are, and that they were wearing these horns as they are described by anthropologists in their rituals and in their ceremonies, and somehow mm-hmm. were involved with rituals, ceremonies, religious metaphors associated with these horned animals.
Okay.
And it's not so unusual to have something like this. In fact, John Muir, in his 1894 book called Mountains of California, depicts a hunter wearing a bighorn sheep headdress when they were hunting bighorn sheep, a sheep hunting disguise with horns and hood in his lithograph. So, and other anthropologists have, in fact, mentioned this as well, that it's not so unusual.
Right.
In my own research in the Coso Range of Eastern California, we found about 200 pictures of these either people, hunters, or animal human figures adorned with bighorn sheep horns.
Mm-hmm.
So something was going on. And then if you go to New Mexico, if you go to Utah, if you go to Nevada, this kind of thing, this depiction of a bighorn sheep set of horns on a human hunter or on some sort of a medicine person or shaman is really a common class or a common depiction. Hmm. There is one of those depictions out on the edge of Little Lake, which is right on 395, just south of Lone Pine. And it was dated by a contemporary, yet somewhat experimental XRF dating, literally just a year or so ago, and it's 2,000 years old. So we do know that this kind of thing is somewhat common. How's that? When you go to Navajo land, as an example, in New Mexico, there's a petroglyph, a rock drawing in Largo Canyon. And it shows an individual wearing either a bighorn sheep horns or, you know, being some sort of a animal human figure or deity. And when one studies the literature of the Navajo, this is a figure called Ganascati. And Ganascati mm-hmm. is, in fact, a deity or a supernatural being. And it's his or her responsibility to replenish the earth, bring the rain, and bring the fertility to the earth. And this figure, besides having bighorn sheep horns, has a humped back or is wearing a backpack or bag that's filled with the seeds of the earth. And it also has a rainbow on his back. And it has eagle feathers, eagle plumes adorning the edges of the backpack. So there's that one.
Wow.
So I could go on and on, but there's many depictions of these horned individuals in some famous settings.
Yeah. Wow. That's really cool. All right. So again, what is all this? What is the relevance of this? We can see that the rock art is, you know, a lot of times we look at rock art and we look at it and say, is this real life that's being depicted? Is this a spiritual conceptualization, you know, born out of some sort of hallucinogenic state, as we've talked about before?
Right.
Or is it something they're actually depicting that they're doing? And it seems like there's some correlation with, yeah, what we're seeing on the rock here is actually something that's going on in real life. So what do you think that means?
Well, as I've studied and sort of drilled down on this, I've tried to sort of get to the heart and soul of what the bighorn sheep itself and wearing the bighorn sheep horns meant to the native people who participated in this kind of religious affair.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, believe it or not, in this day and age, okay, there is a group of native people that wear bighorn sheep headdresses that live in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. they're called the Ram Dancers, and they're the Havasupai. They're human speakers. They're not related to the Ute or the Southern Paiute, but they are the Havasupai Ram dancers. And they believe that they are descendants from a bighorn sheep animal human deity. And this particular ceremony, this ritual, is something that demonstrates their reverence, their prayers, their respect for these remarkable animals. Now, as well, there's a gentleman in Banning, California, who is a descendant of the Serrano and the Cahuilla Indians. These are the native people that lived around Banning and in Palm Springs and that area. And he speaks the Serrano language. It's a Tokic language that's Uto-Aztecan. And he sings songs. He sings bird songs that he inherited as an individual. But he also has ram songs, bighorn sheep songs. And he also believes that the ancestors of his people were, in fact, came from and affiliated with bighorn sheep animal humans, so that when animals were people at the start of the earth, the bighorn sheep was a central, prominent and prestigious figure within their religious tradition or cosmology. So that's rather interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, that is interesting. It makes me wonder, I mean, like you said at the beginning of time, so to speak, in the theology of the people that did all this, you know, when animals were people, that kind of thing, because all the origin stories have, you know, people being animals and, you know, something happening. That's how we get constellations and mountain range names and formations and all kinds of stuff that they had around them.
Exactly.
But it's so amazing to me how much influence the bighorn sheep had. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And why is that? Well, there's a gentleman who is a Hollywood cinematographer who has taken it on his shoulders to study and document the depiction of bighorn sheep, or call it large horned ungulates, all over the world. So he's been to the Altai in Siberia. He's been to Israel. He's been to Africa, the American Southwest, California, and many other places throughout the world. And he finds that consistently, the imagery of these large horned ungulates always plays prominently into the rock drawings, the rock pictures that are found with it nested within the indigenous territories of prehistoric people.
Yeah. I think on that note, we will take a break and come back and wrap up the entire history of the bighorn sheep and animal human headdresses on the last segment. We're going to solve everything. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. We are back for the third and final segment of episode 39 of the Rock Art Podcast, and we are talking about animal-human headdresses and depictions on rock art, and specifically the bighorn sheep headdress you've been talking about for the last two segments. But I want to take a quick side trip on this one, because we have, obviously, rock art evidence dating back, you know, 10 to 14,000 years in Western North America. And that's a lot of time, right? We have rock art dating back a long time. I think the oldest rock art was in I don't know the details of it, but it was in Southern Oregon, I believe, and it was just a few years ago, to somewhere around 12 to 14,000 years ago. I don't know if that was years ago or 12 to 14,000 BCE. I think it was ago.
It's 12 to 14,000. I believe in Nevada or Utah, and it is an expression that was near a dry lake.
Yeah, near Winnemucca Dry Lake. That's right. Yes. It's right outside of Reno. Now I remember that. Yeah. So, well, my question is, we talk about how important the Bighorn sheep were to, you know, a number of different peoples in that area. But that's more than likely because, like you said, these horned animals are always important. These big horned animals that, you know, are just powerful. They're majestic. They're all the things that we say today when we see those animals, right? Like I hit my brakes and pull over to the side of the road if I happen to see bighorn sheep. Like nothing's changed in thousands of years. You know what I mean? We still revere these animals because they're just majestic creatures. So do we have depictions like this and depictions of, more importantly, humans wearing some sort of headdress of some of the big, like, megafauna of, you couldn't wear a mammoth skull, it would crush you, but, you know, like some of the depictions similar to this of some of like the megafauna of the last 6 to 10,000 years, you know, when those animals were the big ones on the landscape.
There is a depiction, actually several depictions of mammoths in Utah, and they're found as scratched, very ancient, you know, 10,000-year-old images, 12,000-year-old images. And there has been a portable image found as well of a mammoth that came from the Florida area as well. So, and with respect to megafauna, very little do we have because it was a very, very early time and one that probably didn't have much in the way of people. Very thinly populated way back when, I would say. But moving forward to about 10,000 and 9,000 years ago, I believe somewhat confidently that that was the beginning of the depiction of bighorn sheep in the rock art of North America.
Okay. Wow, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, we do have a date, an experimental date, for a depiction of bighorn sheep in Nevada that occurred with a fluted Clovis-like point in central Nevada. So that's about the earliest age that I know for that image.
So of the wearable type skulls, for lack of a better way to say that, because like I said, a mammoth skull would crush you. What about other types of animals that are used as, like you said, animal-human headdresses and also maybe the mirrored in depictions on rock art? Do we have other common examples of this that are in the record?
In the old world, in Europe, the deer was, of course, the stag was the indexical animal. They wore headdresses of deer horns. Okay. And they replicated them also in metal. And these are equivalent to age or earlier than their representation in the Americas. So I have an article that was published. It's on my website, on my web presence, on academia.edu. It's with a Ukrainian scholar where we compare the depictions and characterizations of these elements of ceremonial regalia and hunting regalia using the deer and the bighorn sheep, exemplifying these elements of disguises as well as ritualists and ceremony. And if I wanted to get into the symbolism, I'd say that Esther Jacobson, who did a lot of work in the Altai, talks about these animal headdresses as almost a way to be reborn and connecting into the body and knowledge of the animal. And it symbolizes sort of this ancient set of sacred animals to them. And you sort of, when you don the headdress, you're connecting to the power and the prestige and the vitality of these creatures. Kind of a connection to the forces of nature. And I don't think that's so far different from when these hunters glean the animals that are so difficult to acquire, and then they mount their trophies on the walls. But earlier on, you're talking about game animals, and there's sort of an intimate and reciprocal association with these particular game animals. But if you want to go down the route of the shamanism, it's that they were possessed and become the animals themselves during these altered states of consciousness and these trance experiences. And they're able to symbolically and almost telepathically connect with these animals and are able to influence the game animals' behavior. They can talk to the hunters, and then they can tell them where they should hunt, how they where they are, and how they should connect with them and behave to successfully hunt the animal. Hmm. The shells themselves, you know, in terms of the headgear, is sort of a way to almost like little birds dangling above their eyes. And these were seen as sort of metaphoric stars or celestial bodies or little birds. And the way they could, and these shamans, these ritualists could of course do what they call soul flight. They'd fly into the heavens to commune with these ethereal divinities and ancestor deities. And they would then come back and be able to speak with their people and tell them and bring the prayers and the blessings of their deities back to them from the divine realm to the terrestrial realm.
Hmm. You mentioned the somewhat of the function of the headdress being, like you said, you know, help them understand and hunt more of these animals. You know, we talk about hunting magic and things like that all the time.
Right.
But is part of it, I don't know if I have any ethnographic evidence of this, but could part of it also be trying to borrow the power of these animals that they have over the people? Because religious figures through time have always held a certain position of power because they talk to spirits, you know, they commune with spirits, and that's always seen as a powerful thing to people. I mean, even today, you know, priests and the Pope and, you know, religious figures like that are seen as having this sort of power. So do you think it was part of taking the power of the animals, and I don't know what they would use it for, using them as influence or something like that? Or is that now how Native American shamanism worked?
See, the bighorn sheep was sort of the topmost animal. He was the biggest thing on the mountain in part. Sure. And you have to understand that that topmost animal is the most prestigious creature. Also, mm-hmm. and you are prescient in what you're saying, is they believe that bighorn sheep were immortal. And they had infinite power and energy concentrated in the tops of these realms. And sure, with the awe and majesty and also the immortality of these animals, they would glean that power by wearing the headdress. They would supernaturally sort of ensure an abundance of game. They would have this assurance of renewal from sickness to health and drought to rain and infertility to fecundity. All of this success and renewal and transformation is sort of captured in this bighorn sheep metaphor. It's all about cosmic regeneration. It's all about rain. It's all about fertility. It has all of that wrapped up in that one symbol.
Well, I feel like if we want to find more of these headdresses, we should look at the bottoms of steep cliffs and canyons, because if they thought they were stealing the power of the bighorn sheep and could climb mountains like them, they probably met with certain negative ends as they tried to climb the mountain wearing these headdresses.
Yes. Now, fortunately, as they got the bow and arrow, they would then be able to hide in those rock structures, those blinds.
Oh yeah.
And they could shoot them. But earlier on, they were chasing those animals down and they had to stand up to throw that dart. And that must have been a pretty tough way to kill one of those animals, because they're very sure-footed, sure-footed and so fast. And of course, they can go straight up the sides of those hills and precipices, and they love that escape terrain. So all of that was available to them.
Yeah, it's amazing how such a heavy animal can be so agile.
Yes, and it's because of this these cloven hooves, the being an artiodactyl and being adapted to such a rugged and treacherous environment. They also can eat almost anything. They can live on some of the most scraggly plants you can possibly imagine, and they only need to water during the hottest summer months, and then they find their watering holes basically going on these tinajas, these natural tanks that will hold the water, or they can dig for it in other places. But they're also animals that will inhabit a particular area and rarely, if ever, leave. They tend to be very associated with certain pieces of real estate or landforms, and they mm-hmm. they like to return to the same locations over and over. And they have rather small metapopulations. There's not that many desert bighorn. We're talking about, you know, densities that are in the hundreds, even in the best of times. So when we have a mountain range, we might have a few hundred animals. I've heard that there's maybe 500 to 1,000 in the entire Death Valley region. And that area hasn't been hunted since the 1930s or earlier. And that's an enormous, enormous area. And so they've done a lot to allow those animals to proliferate. They basically just need water. The only thing that's been affecting them is when other animals intrude on their territory, such as burros or horses or domestic sheep, they will sometimes catch certain exotic diseases and it'll decimate their whole population.
Wow. All right. So, well, where do we go from here? How do we wrap this up?
The bighorn sheep and animals that are horned animals worldwide have been something to think about and something good to eat as well. Mm-hmm. Lamb chops have been one of my favorites. So, and hunters even today have a similar understanding of the majesty and awe and just the prestige of being and finding and connecting with these animals. To bring it fast forward to modern day, I attended the international event that recognizes, these horned artiodactyls worldwide with hunters. And mm-hmm. there were hundreds of people from all over the world there representing various places that the hunters might go to hunt and kill these animals. And I sat one table away from a gentleman who was obviously ultra affluent, and he paid $500,000 for the privilege of hunting a bighorn sheep in the California wow. desert.
Wow.
So they're obviously valuable and and still seen as one of the most prestigious quarries one can ever get. But it's rather interesting to see over the thousands of years how we still revere and connect with this most majestic, topmost animal, indexical creature.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that is a good place to end this podcast, and I'm glad we got to talk about this. It's always very fascinating. Maybe we should take a little bit of a turn since we've talked about it so much and try to find a bighorn sheep expert. I'd just like to know a little bit more about the animal and, you know, because people change, right? Humans change. I mean, there's some things about humans that don't change, but animals really don't change. I mean, they might change their patterns, but
at the beginning of our interviews and this podcast, we interviewed yeah. Carlos Gallinger, and he's mm-hmm. one of the world's experts on bighorn sheep. So I'll see if
right.
I can see if I can get him back, and we'll revisit the topic using his skill and his discussion of what he knows about hunting, the behavior, and the association of bighorn with rock art in the desert west.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should try to we'll grab the link for that and put it in the show notes so we can link back to that episode. I completely forgot about that, but now it's coming back to me. So, yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Doctor. It's been a pleasure as always.
And thank you, Chris. And thank you to all of our listeners out there in Archaeology Podcast land. God bless you. See you on the flip-flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, Lyceum, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.